everyone, and welcome to Minute 98 of Season 8 of Over a Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we foobar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Scott Myers, Associate Professor of Screenwriting at DePaul University. Welcome back to the show, Scott.
Great to be here, Rob. We continue our foray into Saving Private Ryan.
Yes, we definitely do. So Minute 98 begins with Miller once again explaining his new orders, and ends with the arguments starting to simmer and start moving towards to boiling over. we ended things yesterday with us all believing that that Miller's about to go kill Steamboat Willie, and in the end he puts a blindfold on him and starts giving instructions of that he should be marching 1,000 paces, and he finishes his thought in this minute by saying in that direction. And then he says, then he can take off the blindfold. We'll be gone, and he turns himself into the first Allied patrol he comes across. Now, does this sound in any way believable to you, that this is what someone in Miller's capacity would do and say?
It's tough, because as I mentioned in a even in the most recent draft, or the closest draft of the shooting script, they kept him for a while. You know, they traveled with him. There was an overnight thing, you know. So the idea that they couldn't travel with the guy as an excuse doesn't seem terribly plausible.
What do you remember from those scenes of where they travel with him? I mean, they take him in tow as a prisoner, basically?
Yeah, basically. There is a bit more sort of the humanizing aspect of it, particularly with Upham and him. You know, they spend a lot of time together. They're smoking cigarettes. They're chatting and whatnot. So, and I think that, as I recall from reading the script, that rubs the soldiers even more the wrong way. But it's, you know, it goes on for, I don't know, a few pages at least, as I recall, before it gets to a situation where, you know, he's no longer with them. So to your question, it's a good question. I don't know. I mean, it speaks to, you know, this may be one of those things where it's like, well, it's Tom Hanks. You know, it's, and, you know, there's the movie experience of like being in the story universe. But then you go, yeah, you know, is Tom going to shoot this guy? I don't think so. So I guess this makes sense that he would let him go. But you're right. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. You'd think you'd keep him until you run into some other Allied soldiers, you know, or. And then just hand him over or something. So I don't know. It's a good question. Did you stumble on this?
No, I wasn't able to get an answer to it. I mean, because when I look at it, you know, he doesn't even try and get information out of him by saying, okay, tell us where there are other Germans. You know, we're about to kill you. Tell us, you know, tell us where, which way it's safe to go. You know, it's not like Steamboat Willie's going to be able to tell him where James Ryan is. But, you know, they can at least get other useful information from him. And they don't even try.
Hmm. Well, in the script, I do remember in the script, they are trying to get information from him, but it has nothing to do with, like, the larger scope of things. They're trying to get him to confess this, whether he shot Wade or not. You know, the other soldiers are like, ask him if he, you know, he's the guy that shot him.
He said that last week, didn't he? If I remember correctly, we discussed that a little bit last week. Where he said, ask him if he shot Wade. Yeah. And, you know, obviously, even if he did, he's not going to say, I did it, you know.
Right. Sure.
Yeah. He's a little bit smarter than that. Yeah, oh, it was me, of course. Yes, I killed your friend and I'm about to kill all of you too. You know, that type of thing. So again, to me, it seems as if this decision is made too quickly by Miller. You know, where,
yeah,
you know, if from what you're saying in the previous, you know, drafts of the script where they're with them for a while, it would then make a little more sense. You know, Steamboat Willie will grow on Miller. And so he'll start seeing him in a more human way and then say, okay, maybe I don't have to kill him. But here, this is a maximum of a few hours. Probably not even that long. Depends on how long it takes them to dig the graves. You know, that's it. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's because there is, I mean, there's a firefight. They're in the, you know, there's a, Ryben's told to be on watch, as I recall, and then there's a firefight with a tank and some stuff, and then there's a whole thing about cigarettes. The guy wants to smoke a cigarette, and that pisses people off, and then they go into this thing digging the ditch, and he does a little bit of you know, Mickey Mouse, you know, that sort of stuff. But yeah, it's, I don't know, it's weird.
Yeah. Yeah, again, I mean, the movie is already 2 hours and 49 minutes, so, you know, they're somewhat, you know, they didn't want to, you know, they had to cut things here and there. But this is one of the first instances that I can think of that we've come across so far where they might have needed a little more time here. You know, that it seems as if they truncated this decision too, you know, too much.
So I just looked up the script and the time when they intersect with the character that is known as Steamboat Willie, and then it's like literally an entire day later. It's in the morning where Miller has done this thing where he blindfolds him and sends him off. Is like 10, 12 pages. I mean, so to your point, there's a lot of time where they spend with this character before Miller makes this decision, and it's not spur of the moment. It's the decision is revealed. I'm just looking at the script. It's the next morning. There they are, and he's got this guy blindfolded and sends him off. You know, so he's clearly had more time to think about it. But I guess Spielberg is figuring, well, given the heat of the moment, that he's going to have to make a decision quickly, and does. So that's the film version of it.
And the firefight that they have is not the one that we're going to see in 2 weeks, you know, with the half track before they meet Ryan, right?
No, I'm just going to go back through this. There's a tiger tank coming through the low branches. So I was wrong. They don't really fight. I think they just hear them. They're very quiet. And I guess that now that I'm looking at it, they are hoping that the German will stay quiet, and that maybe helps them. Yeah. Okay. So I misremembered that, but yeah. So there isn't really a fight. But the Germans pass by, and Steamboat Willie doesn't say anything. So, you know, it's another kind of a thing that may up their trust or respect for him, or I don't know, something that would make it easier for Miller to say, okay, I'm going to let this guy live. You know,
right.
And interesting.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. I read the you know, the novelization of this movie a long time ago. I think I need to go back and look into that a little bit more, because, you know, they do have some interesting stuff that was added or that was taken away, you know, that is in the novelization. You know, like the whole thing about the Jeep at the beginning and all that stuff that we've talked about, which I'm glad they cut that out. It's I didn't like that scene too much, with the Jeep.
Yeah.
with how they got the Jeep and all that stuff, where they basically it sort of stole the Jeep and whatever. It works better here, except for the editing goof where we see them in the Jeep. For a few seconds.
Yeah. I think that generally speaking, audiences nowadays need less exposition. I think, it's a generalization, but they like movies to move more quickly. And I think maybe it's just because of a generation of people who've grown up on video games where they participate in the decision-making process, that one of the things that filmmakers have learned is you can cut into scenes late, you can cut out of scenes early, you can compress events, which makes the reader have to kind of, be involved, more involved in the process. And so if I'm looking at that scene now, the movie was 94, I believe. I was thinking
94 was Schindler's List.
Schindler's List, exactly. Sorry, 93 was Schindler's List. I saw it in 94, the night before the earthquake, Northridge earthquake in LA. That was quite something. But 98, I think that decision now, like if the movie came out now, and you wouldn't have any problem with that decision because you want things to move along. And also it's getting the audience going, wow, that's interesting. Would I have done that? That makes sense. Because they're involved now in the process. They're trying to figure out what Miller's motivation is. So I guess what I'm saying is that the 98, the film version of it, probably would play better now than it would even back in 1998. Just the audience like things to move more quickly.
Correct. Especially since the way that this movie has, as we mentioned at the beginning of the week, you have the first 28 minutes that is super fast, paced excellent, amazingly, stuff like that. And then you have some slower moments. And then, and then it goes back into something fast and then slower moments, and then it goes back into something fast. It keeps, keeps changing the speed of things along the
way. Well, okay. So Larry Gordon, who produced K-9, he produced Die Hard, 48 Hours, Predator. Mm-hmm. When I was working with him on K-9, he told me, he said, he's from Mississippi, a Southern accent. He said, "Scott, every 10 minutes, you got to have something go whammo." So, and that'd be, it's known as like a whammo theory of writing, for action movies, you got to have something. But what happens is you have those action events, like you were just talking about, but that buys you time to spend time with characters, the interaction scenes, the revelation scenes, the more intimate scenes. But then every 10 minutes or so, something's got to go whammo. And for a movie like this, absolutely, it's an action war movie. So there you go, the whammo theory of screenwriting.
Would you classify this movie as an action movie?
I'd say I'd be curious what it says on IMDb. They often list like three different genres when they tag a movie. It has action in it, but it's probably more drama. But I mean, with that 28 minute
IMDb,
opening, IMDb, I don't know how else...
IMDb lists as a drama and war. That's it.
Drama and war, and that's it. So war assumes action. Yeah. Well, it's definitely a drama, and it definitely has action in it. I would probably, if it were me, I'd say it's a action drama or drama action, kind of a cross cross genre film. But yeah.
Right. No, you see, when I look at this movie, I don't think of it as an action movie. That's the thing. When I think of an action movie, so I think of Die Hard. I think most of the Schwarzenegger, Stallone, Bruce Willis movies, but I don't think of them as, this is a movie where I first and foremost think of this as a drama.
Yeah, and I think Tom Hanks would not
drama
have done
with
it
action
if it were straight
ahead. That type of thing.
Drama with action. I don't think Tom Hanks would have done it if it was straight ahead action, because he's not that kind of actor. He wants to play roles that, and not to demean action movies, but, a straight ahead genre film, an action film, the well written and film things have interesting characters, like even John McClane in Die Hard had a whole character arc with regard to his wife. So, it's not just like him shooting people.
Correct.
But yeah, this is, I think you're right. I that's how I would say it. This is a drama with action. That's a good way of typifying it.
Okay. Excellent. Again, the idea that Miller has convinced himself that Steamboat Willie is going to turn himself into any Allied patrol he comes across is also somewhat farcical. Because once you let someone go, as he's going to go 1,000 paces, he's going to take off that blindfold, and he's going to run as fast as he can to some place where he knows he'll be safe, and it's not going to be into an Allied patrol because they're going to shoot him. So yeah,
Yeah,
I don't.
in the script they even have, like, Mellish says, "I can't say as I understand the logic of it myself, sir," when he's talking about the decision to let him go. They have like this whole philosophical debate about it, and as I recall, they're even like sort of making bets, like whether Steamboat Willie's gonna bump into things. Like, $10 says he falls flat in the space, you know. I mean, they're like making light of him as he falls down, and so the mood is different at the end
Yeah.
of where he goes down
Interesting.
in the script.
Right. Yeah, for sure. And then Upham goes, "Thank you, sir." And Ryben, who I know a lot of people don't like Ryben. I love Ryben. He's actually one of my favorite characters in this movie. He's the typical Brooklyn guy that is gonna say whatever's on his mind. He doesn't care about anything. He doesn't care what people are gonna think, what people are gonna do, nothing. And he goes, "You gotta be kidding me. We're letting him go?" And then the response is, "He's a POW, Ryben. Can't take him with us. Our guys will pick him up sooner or later." So again, Miller is. I think he's being a little naive thinking that, but I think I think he's just saying it, but he doesn't necessarily believe it. But his idea is we can't drag this guy with us. So what are our choices? We can either kill him or we can let him go and hope for the best. And I think that's the choice that Miller seems to have made here, which is obviously
Yeah,
detrimental to his own future, but yeah.
not to advance too far ahead, because it happens a few minutes later, but he does make a line later on, as I recall, I think it's in the movie, where he says, "I just basically I want to get home, and in order to get home, I got to find Ryan." And so
That's
that's
right.
probably the underlying thing. It's like having this guy along is going to be an encumbrance. It's going to be a It's going to slow me down. It's another thing I have to deal with. I just want to focus on getting Ryan and getting back home. So I think that's probably the underlying logic going on there with him.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes it's. I think next week he talks about he gives that line. Yeah. But then Ryben just says, "Well, that's only if he doesn't get picked up by his own Wehrmacht first and throw him back into circulation. Captain, you just let the enemy go." And then Mellish throws in his 2 cents and goes, "This is such bull." And Jackson then responds, "You all got that right." So none of these guys are happy about the situation.
No.
As far as they're concerned, they should. And Upham still tries to defend him. He goes, "Bullshit, right? This is bull. Shooting a prisoner, that'd be okay." And he goes, "Upham, shut your mouth." And he goes, "It's against the goddamn rules." "Yeah, the goddamn rules just walked off with your new friend. But I guess that was a decent thing to do, huh, Captain?" So again, Ryben has no problem speaking his mind here, which is great. You probably understand this a lot better than I do, but from a screenwriting perspective, it sounds okay. Here they're giving us the two sides of the argument, and they're letting us think about, what are the repercussions of each side of that argument, about letting him go or
Exactly.
getting rid of him.
Exactly. Exactly. And Ryben's got plenty of logic behind his point of view.
Well,
So you've got two
and as we
characters.
know,
I'm sorry, go
Ryben is
ahead.
right.
That's true. So, you can't have drama without conflict. You got two. It's basically they're having a philosophical debate, with two different perspectives. With Upham sort of in the middle, but siding with Miller's decision, and of course it accelerates so as we go forward.
Yeah, seriously. And I mean, I love the way that during the course of this conversation, they keep showing us Steamboat Willie in the distance, mumbling and walking off in whatever direction they pushed him to go. I think they should have like spun him around first before they let him go. You know, they say, okay, walk 1,000 paces.
That would have been funny.
It might have been.
You're right, because he does. Yeah, you've got a bunch of medium shots that he does, Spielberg group shots, and then you've got some close-ups like Ryben's face. I remember when he gets in Miller's face and up. But then you got these long shots of this hapless character kind of stumbling along with his hands out in front of him.
But he's still able to follow the route.
You know, which the path. The
path.
It's this path, right?
No, but it's not a straight path. Mm-hmm. He turns.
No, yeah, he turns, yeah.
So in other words, that blindfold is probably not very tight. You know, he's able to see a little more than what he probably should. He's like, all right, I have some buddies on the other side of the field. I'm gonna go over there. You know, when I'm out of sight from Miller and his men. Who knows? Yeah. And that's how this minute ends with this the beginning of this argument. We're gonna have to wait and see tomorrow. Where that argument takes everyone. So, did you have anything else to say about this particular minute?
No, it's just building tension, and again, you're leaving it often a great way. You know, I talked about this idea of nowadays we try to get the audience as well. It's always been the case, getting to participate in the process, the storytelling, the unfolding storytelling, mm-hmm. but maybe even more so nowadays because of a generation growing up with video games and that thing. But you'll notice that often you'll have characters posing these questions, which is a great thing to do. Like but I guess that was the decent thing to do, huh, Captain?
Right.
And so that causes the audience to have to think, yeah, okay, so what was that, a right or wrong? And now we're engaged along with these characters in the moment. So I think that was a very effective way of tapping out this minute and moving the story, the scene even further into some heightened emotions.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So every Wednesday we have a segment called World War II Wednesday, where my guests will give their top five World War II themed related movies. So Scott, once again, I didn't make this homework simple for you or for anybody. But
well, there's a ton of World War II movies.
Exactly. So once again, start with your number five and work your way up.
I'm going to start with two movies that I saw when I was a kid. My dad was an Air Force colonel, so, you know, I lived on Air Force bases and quite familiar with the military experience as a military brat. But, you know, he would take me to see these war movies. The Longest Day, which like starred, is one of those, you know, cast of thousands movie. I'll say that is number five. The Dirty Dozen is number four. Of course, now that references Tom Hanks. Remember in Sleepless in Seattle, that's they're talking about Dirty Dozen, and Jim Brown is running and dies. You know, they get all weepy. That's a very funny scene in Sleepless in Seattle. I want to include a Billy Wilder movie because he did Stalag 17. Because Billy Wilder is my favorite filmmaker. That's number three. Number two, Inglourious Basterds by Quentin Tarantino, just because it's just an incredible Tarantino film. And then the last one, it may surprise you, I saw it recently again, and it's really quite powerful. Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. You ever seen this movie with David Bowie and Tom Conti? It's these prisoners of war being held by the Japanese. One of the actors was actually very famous in Japan as a comedy guy. His name was Takeshi Kitano. And then he later on went and did some really interesting, he did a movie, I can't remember the name of it, it was quite funny and odd, almost bizarre, I'll see if I can remember the name of it. But then the one of the actors is also the composer, and the music is really, the soundtrack's quite excellent. So Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. Tom Conti, by the way, did not understand Japanese at all. One of the reasons why he's a guy who connects with the Japanese hierarchy is because he does speak Japanese, but the actor didn't know it. All the Japanese he spoke was he learned phonetically, which is pretty phenomenal. And then, of course, David Bowie's great in it, you know. That would be my number one. Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence.
Excellent. That is a great list. Thank you very much for that. So, Scott, would you like to once again tell people where they can find you?
Well, there's my blog, goingtothestory.com. As I mentioned, it's this, be celebrating its 17th birthday in May. It's got articles on everything related to writing and screenwriting. There's thousands of articles. Screenwritingmasterclass.com is my online educational resource. I teach at a film school at DePaul University in Chicago, where I'm an associate professor. And then my book, The Protagonist Journey, an introduction to character-driven screenwriting and storytelling.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, find me on Instagram, find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow. Earn this.
Solitude. You